David Iacolucci, Tobin Shackelford, Zoran Yankovic, Joseph Mark Dilema, Sama Wale, and Rawan Kasem. Oh, this Saturday, I'll be moderating the Belmarsh Tribunal with journalist Ryan Grimm at the National Press Club at 2 p.m. on Julian Assange and the Biden administration's crackdown on free speech and the First Amendment. You can watch the live stream at Democracy Now!'s YouTube channel. That's Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with the whole team here in Dubai, UAE.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
My name is Mike. I work at KBOO as the data coordinator. I'm a KBOO host. I do a little show called Pandemonium, and I am a KBOO listener. I love listening to KBOO because it doesn't sound like anything else. I wish I could take credit for that. I'd love to say the reason KBOO sounds so interesting and different is because we have the best DJs, the best reporters, the best volunteers. I believe we do. I think we have an amazing community, but I don't think that's why KBOO sounds the way that it does. KBOO sounds different because of the way we are funded. KBOO is funded by you, the listener. Everyone gets the same radio, and you contribute what you can when you decide to, and there's no advertiser interfering in the relationship between you and the programmers. They say that's not supposed to work. They've been telling KBOO that will never work for 55 years now, and you, the listener, keep proving them wrong. So please help make sure KBOO continues sounding different by keeping KBOO listener-sponsored, independent, and non-commercial. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift to KBOO at kboo.fm/give right now, and thank you so much.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, county commissioners have asked state regulators to block continued storage of crude oil in Portland.
Two Multnomah County corrections officers have been charged with misconduct in the deaths of two inmates.
And in national news, Hunter Biden faces new charges in California.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 8th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going to online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Josh Salem. Multnomah County commissioners have asked state regulators at the Department of Environmental Quality to block Zenith Energy's continued storage of crude oil in Portland. In their letter, the commission asked the DEQ to deny Zenith an upcoming air quality re-permit, citing the fact that Zenith has increased the amount of crude oil and diesel that it moved through Portland over the past 2 years, and that the increase has heightened risks for explosions, fires, and spills in the area. John Wozzetinski, director of the Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, said, quote, "Our assessment is that Zenith Energy continues to be a fossil fuel company that presents a danger to the community," end quote. That stance stands in contrast to the city of Portland, which recently gave the company a controversial approval for 5 more years of crude storage. The city claimed at the time that Zenith Energy's purported eventual move to renewable energy meets Portland's climate goals. The approval was met with disbelief and anger from local neighbors and environmental groups, especially after it was reported earlier this year that city leaders met with Zenith management privately on more than one occasion, and that those leaders seemed to inappropriately influence the approval process. Zenith is a Texas-based company that is one of 11 fossil fuel terminals along a 6-mile stretch of the Willamette River in northwest Portland.
A Multnomah County grand jury has indicted two county correction officers for official misconduct in the deaths of two inmates this year. Although they did not provide specific details on the indictment, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office said that deputies James Brockmiller and Michael Mashuro have been placed on administrative leave. In a statement that the Sheriff's Office said, quote, "In the course of the respective adult in custody death investigations, MCSU detectives learned that Brock Miller and Masuro may not have performed their job duties as required," end quote. Seven inmates have died while in custody in Multnomah County this year. According to the medical examiner's office, three of the deaths were due to natural causes, two were suicides, and one was drug overdose. Four of the deaths are still under investigation. The sheriff's office did not say which of the investigations involved the deputies under indictment.
A new measure in Congress proposes voting rights for people with felony convictions. That legislation would reinstate participation in elections to nearly 4.6 million citizens. Doug McVeigh has more on the story.
New legislation has been introduced in Congress to guarantee the right to vote for people with felony convictions. The official title of H.R. 6643, the Inclusive Democracy Act, is an act to guarantee the right to vote for all citizens regardless of conviction of a criminal offense and for other purposes. The measure would also extend the right to vote to people who are currently incarcerated. The lead sponsor, Representative Ayanna Pressley, spoke at a press event on Wednesday, December 6th.
The crisis of mass incarceration has ravaged our communities, destabilized families, and exacerbated generational trauma. A criminal legal system that disproportionately criminalizes Black and Brown folks and denies us our basic dignity and humanity. A precise, coordinated, and targeted assault on our voting rights that is meant to exclude these very communities from participating in our democracy. Let me make it plain. The right to vote is sacred in America, and it is essential to citizenship, and all citizens deserve a voice in our democracy. But today, nearly 4.6 million citizens are denied the right to vote because of a criminal conviction barring them from voting in our federal elections. That is 4.6 million people. 4.6 million people, disproportionately Black Americans, who are unfairly disenfranchised and are unable to make their voices heard in our elections. In 48 states across our country, we have a confusing and inconsistent patchwork of laws that treat different crimes as felonies and set different standards for disenfranchisement. What this means is that states can arbitrarily make decisions about who to disenfranchise and for how long, often resulting in people who are actually eligible to vote foregoing voting due to confusion or to avoid further criminalization. These disparities didn't just happen overnight. They're the result of decades of precise, intentional, and legislated policy violence. And as lawmakers, we have an opportunity and an obligation to reject this unjust status quo and advance bold policies that strengthen our democracy and make it more inclusive. That's why we're here today, to introduce the Inclusive Democracy Act, a historic, brand new, first of its kind bill that will end the stain of felony disenfranchisement in America and guarantee the right to vote for incarcerated, informally incarcerated citizens.
That was Representative Ayanna Pressley speaking at a press event December 6th announcing the introduction in Congress of the Inclusive Democracy Act, H.R. 6643, an act to guarantee the right to vote for all citizens regardless of conviction of a criminal offense. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
A new report from the Economic Opportunity Institute reveals what it calls the true cost of healthcare in Washington. The group is calling on state lawmakers to do more to address rising healthcare costs. Mark Moran has more on the story.
Two reports from the Insurance Commissioner's Office and the State Attorney General reveal an analysis of what they call the true cost of healthcare in Washington. Based on the results, the Economic Opportunity Institute is asking state lawmakers to do more to address consolidation and sharply rising costs. Healthcare costs nationwide have been on the rise. The Institute's Sam Hatzenbieler says the AG's report shows costs in Washington State outpace the national average. What she describes as insufficient regulation has led to more consolidation of healthcare providers and much higher prices for patients.
We are seeing that they're able to monopolize the market and charge higher and higher prices. Patients, labor, business, we're saying enough is enough. The bottom line is that Washington consumers are being priced out of the healthcare that we need.
The Institute has launched a Fair Health Prices campaign to educate consumers and prompt state lawmakers to take action. The group is calling for more affordable drug prices, regulating healthcare provider mergers, and addressing anti-competitive contracting strategies. All these proposed fixes, Hatzenbeler says, would increase accountability on spending and help slow the skyrocketing costs of healthcare. Costs, the state insurance commissioner's report projects, will go even higher.
Annual out-of-pocket expenses for people with insurance can reach up to almost $19,000 a year. The Office of Insurance Commissioner just approved a 9% average increase for plans in 2024. That is on top of an 8% average increase that we saw in plans this year.
The Institute also says 81% of Washington residents report worrying about health care cost increases. Large providers say higher costs are driven by aggressive medical research and the latest treatments for illness and disease. Despite these claims, the United States has the lowest life expectancy rate among the world's developed nations. I'm Mark Moran for Washington News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden, has been indicted on 9 tax charges in California. This special counsel investigation into his business dealings comes in the lead-up period to the 2024 election. 3 felony and 6 misdemeanor charges were brought yesterday. They include filing a false return and tax evasion felonies, as well as misdemeanor failure to file and failure to pay. The new charges come in addition to previous federal firearms charges, which allege Biden lied about his drug use when he bought a firearm in 2018 while struggling with addiction to crack cocaine. A plea deal over the summer on the latter charges would have spared him jail time. Now, that case may go to possible trial, just as his father campaigns for re-election. The new charges are centered on at least $1.4 million in taxes Hunter Biden owed during 2016 and 2019. Biden's defense attorney, Abby Lowell, accused a special counsel investigating this of bowing to Republican pressure in the case. Lowell said, quote, based on the facts and the law, if Hunter's last name was anything other than Biden, the charges in Delaware and now California would not have been brought, end quote. The White House declined to comment on the new indictments, referring questions to the Justice Department or Hunter Biden's personal representatives. The charges provide details on Biden's alleged spending on drugs, strippers, luxury hotels, and exotic cars, said to be everything but his taxes. Hunter Biden told Congress he would testify publicly, but Republicans demand a closed-door session. If convicted, Biden, 53, could face a maximum of 17 years in prison. Meanwhile, congressional Republicans are pursuing impeachment inquiry into President Biden, claiming he was engaged in an influence-peddling scheme with his son. The House should vote next week on formally authorizing the inquiry. However, no evidence has emerged to prove that Joe Biden, in his current or previous office, abused his role or accepted bribes. The defense believes immunity provisions from the original plea deal on the gun charges remain in effect. Part of that agreement was signed by a prosecutor before the deal was junked. Prosecutors disagree, pointing out the documents weren't signed by a judge and thus are invalid. Hunter Biden's gross income totaled some $7 million between 2016 and 2020, according to prosecutors. He had roles on the board of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma and a Chinese private equity fund, as well as his position at a law firm. Hunter did eventually file his taxes in 2020 while facing a child support case in Arkansas, and the back taxes were paid by a third party.
You're listening to the end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the end of the year. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, a look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather, cloudy with light winds and a low of 37. Tomorrow's weather, see the rains return with a high of 44. Periods of heavy rain are possible. Today in history, in 1660, a woman appeared on stage in a public performance for the first time. Credit is given both to Margaret Hughes and Anne Marshall in the role of Desdemona in the production of Shakespeare's Othello. Quote of the day is from Othello. Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster which doth mock, the meat it feeds on.
President Vladimir Putin announced plans today to remain Russia's president for at least 6 more years. He named himself as a candidate in the presidential election next March, which experts say he is certain to win. Putin announced his decision after a Kremlin award ceremony at which war veterans and others pleaded with him to seek re-election. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov claimed those remarks were spontaneous. The extremely costly Ukrainian war raised questions about Putin's popularity. However, his reign has recently been marked by strong attacks against dissenters, including imprisoning his critics. Putin said, quote, I won't hide it from you. I had various thoughts about it over time, but now you're right. It's necessary to make a decision. I will run for president of the Russian Federation, end quote. The announcement was felt to be fairly low-key, possibly reflecting a Kremlin spin effort to emphasize Putin's alleged modesty. According to one independent pollster, about 80% of the Russian populace approves of Putin's performance, but it's hard to know if that support is genuine since even mild criticism is strongly addressed. Putin is already the longest-serving Kremlin leader since Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, who died in 1953. He is expected to face only token opposition on the ballot. Putin's rule has spanned 5 U.S. presidencies, from Bill Clinton to Joe Biden. He became acting president in 1999, when Boris Yeltsin unexpectedly resigned. He was elected to his first term in March of 2000.
A group of international science and academics have signed on to an open letter calling all to join them in collective climate action to prevent global climate disaster. Scientists Rebellion, the group behind the letter, runs direct action, public education, and other campaigns aimed at forcing the world's leaders to take action to address the ongoing climate crisis. The open letter, released during the 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP, has been signed by nearly 2,000 scientists, academics, and allies. It reads in part, quote, none of the climate disasters unfolding before our eyes were inevitable, end quote. Quote, in 1992, virtually all countries promised to avoid dangerous anthropologic interference with the climate system. And 27, Global UN Climate Conference later, carbon emissions are 60% higher than they were in 1992. Our political leaders are catastrophically failing us. As scientists and academics, we believe it is now necessary to step up and engage in collective climate action. Like thousands of people around the world, many of us have been advocating and protesting for a better world in a variety of ways, including peaceful, civil disobedience. Join us. End quote.
The Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, has threatened to prosecute any doctor who provides an abortion to Kate Cox after a Texas judge ruled this week that Cox may obtain an abortion under the narrow medical exceptions offered by the state bans. The Center for Reproductive Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of Cox after she learned that her fetus has trisomy 18, a fatal chromosomal condition. It was determined that continuing the pregnancy could threaten Cox's life and future fertility. On Thursday, Travis County Judge Maya Gamble issued a temporary restraining order on the state to permit Cox's doctor to perform the abortion. Late Thursday night, the state appealed, asking the Texas Supreme Court to immediately block Gamble's order. Attorney General Paxton then called several Houston area hospitals, advising them to ignore the court order and threatening hospital administrators and health providers with prosecution should they go forward with an abortion procedure. Cox's case marks the first time a pregnant person has asked a court for an emergency abortion since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973.
An antitrust lawsuit against poultry producers has resulted in a payout of over $40 million to Washington families. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh has more on the story.
The state of Washington is sending checks to more than 400,000 households as a result of successful antitrust lawsuits against large food producers. Washington State's Attorney General's office recovered more than $35 million as a result of a price-fixing lawsuit filed against poultry producers in 2021. 15 out of the 19 broiler chicken producers named in the suit settled with the state. Two of the remaining 4 producers merged after the lawsuit was filed. A trial is scheduled for October 2024 for 3 of the remaining co-conspirators. Foster Farms LLC, Wayne Sanderson Farms, Inc., and House of Rayford Farms, Inc. Another $5 million came from cases against major tuna companies. Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson spoke at a news conference Wednesday, December 6th, to announce the payout.
Here's the bottom line. If you bought chicken or canned tuna in the past decade, these illegal price-fixing conspiracies touched your wallet. In 2020, I was the first state attorney general to sue tuna companies for their role in a price-fixing conspiracy. From 2010 through 2013, executives at Starkist, Bumblebee, and Chicken of the Sea, all familiar companies for most Washingtonians, called each other, texted, used private emails, and in some instances, had face-to-face meetings to avoid detection so they could exchange internal company policies and data. A former Bumblebee Tuna CEO complained to executives at the other companies that canned tuna was too cheap, that's in quotes, too cheap, and he wanted to raise the price on consumers. His subordinate said he gave, quote, very clear direct orders to fix the prices on cans of tuna products. Two of those companies, one of their foreign parent companies and a former executive, are paying more than $5.1 million to my office as a result of our lawsuits. Additionally, the other set of cases, we've won approximately $35.5 million from our 2021 lawsuit against 19 chicken producers that account for about 95% of the chicken sold in the United States.
That was Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson at a news conference December 6th announcing a payout of over $40 million to Washington households resulting from his lawsuits against major food producers over price fixing. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
Last week, Oregon Secretary of State LaVon Griffin-Vallade announced that she would not keep former President Donald Trump's name off the state's primary election ballot. A review by the state's Department of Justice advised her that she did not have the authority to determine whether presidential primary candidates are qualified. But an advocacy group, Free Speech for People, has filed a lawsuit with the Oregon Supreme Court. The group seeks to have the Supreme Court require Griffin-Vallade to disqualify Trump from the primary and general election ballots or demonstrate why she shouldn't be required to do so. The group maintains that Trump is ineligible because of the 14th Amendment. The amendment states that anyone who took an oath to uphold the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection or rebellion is unqualified to hold office. The lawsuit states that, quote, multiple judges and government officials have determined that January 6th was an insurrection and that Trump was responsible, end quote. The group believes that the Oregon Secretary of State has the responsibility to vet candidates, as Griffin-Vallade did when she disqualified four Republican state senators who missed more than 10 floor sessions, and as former Secretary Shamia Fagan did when she said that Nicholas Kristof did not meet the residency requirements to run for governor. The suit says that, quote, Oregon law leaves the secretary no neutral position, end quote. A spokesperson for Griffin-Vallade said the Secretary of State stands by her decision, but will follow any direction from the court.
Tribal leaders identify substance abuse and mental health as priorities for the federal government to address in tribal communities. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders from across the country say substance use and mental health issues are priorities for the federal government to address with tribes. The topic was part of the agenda Thursday at the White House Tribal Nations Conference at the Interior Department. During a panel on substance use with tribal leaders, Department of Justice Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta told the audience the DOJ is learning from tribes. She says that's helping them adjust with what they're doing wrong and will fill gaps that supports tribal solutions. A concern among leaders is combating the fentanyl crisis, which Gupta says the agency is working hard on.
The Justice Department is obviously in the fentanyl crisis doing everything that we can to cut off the supply chain, cartels in Mexico and companies in China, et cetera. But we are also taking what I heard very loudly and clearly, the kind of prevention, intervention, recovery, treatment approach too. And we have to support the whole bandwidth, and it won't be done through the Justice Department alone. It will be done in coordination with all of the agencies and many more here at the federal government.
The governor of the Gila River Indian community in Arizona, Stephen Rowe Lewis, says substance use is impacting tribal communities across the country hard, including in his home state.
In the state of Arizona, the state doesn't have the resources to address this widespread cross-cutting issue. You know, it has to do with enforcement. It has to do with also providing the resources, supporting the tribes with those resources to address the horrible scourge of drug and alcohol abuse and all the social issues. And it's not just that. It's not just those individuals, our loved ones, our relatives. It's the families as well. And it's also providing them those wraparound services and the housing as well. When you have the state, even though it's a state issue, but it's using federal funds and Medicaid funds and Indian Health Service resources as well.
Sharon Hildebrand, vice president of Tanana Chiefs Conference in Alaska, says one thing that can help is recognizing Indian country in Alaska.
We feel it's really important that the DOJ addresses the issue of recognizing Indian country, because in their funding formulas, Alaska is not recognized as Indian country. So it's important that we bring that forward in terms of funding, not only for Alaska, but for everyone in terms of equity.
The two-day summit was an opportunity for tribal leaders to engage directly with federal and White House officials. Thursday afternoon, leaders met with a number of agency officials in private meetings. Before the summit concluded, there were panels on Native families and children, Native languages and cultures, and tribal economic development. The Wind River Food Sovereignty Project is working to address food insecurity and lack of access to healthy food on the reservation. It's now one step closer to that goal. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more.
After 5 years of connecting people to the land through food, the Wind River Food Sovereignty Project is finally getting some land of its own. The group helps to increase the supply of healthy and affordable food on the Wind River Reservation by supporting local food production. The 30-acre property is in Fort Washakie and will be home to a demonstration farm and a learning garden. Kelly Pingree is an enrolled member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes and is one of the project's co-directors. She says she hopes the land can also be a healing and relaxing space.
Gardening always made me happy. Planting something just makes you happy. Watching it grow makes you happy.
The group also hopes to build a walking path around the property and plans to host educational classes about growing and preserving indigenous foods. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 8th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bodwell, Doug McVeigh, Jasmine Moneymaker, Chris Gao, Zoe Carina, and your co-anchor, Josh Salem. The producer is Jezaniah Hawthorne, and our engineer is Zoe Carina. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, and Mike Moran. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programmings, including evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin with Janine Jackson.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show on December 7th, the news from Gaza continues horrific. The Washington Post is reporting, citing Gaza Health Ministry reports, that Israel's continued assault throughout the region has killed at least 350 people in the past 24 hours, bringing the death toll of the Israeli military campaign, launched after the October 7th attack by Hamas that killed a reported 1,200 people, to more than 17,000. In this country, Columbia University has suspended two student groups protesting in support of Palestinian human beings and human rights, though the official message couldn't specify which policies exactly had been violated. There are many important and terrible things happening in the world right now, from fossil fuel companies working to undo any democratic restraints on their ability to profit from planetary destruction, to drug makers who have devastated the lives of millions of people using the legal system to say money actually can substitute for accountability, to an upcoming presidential election that is almost too much to think about, and a Beltway press corps acting like it's just another day. But the devastation of Gaza and the vehement efforts to silence anyone who wants to challenge it, and the failure of those efforts, as people nevertheless keep speaking up, keep protesting, is the story for today. Sonia Meyerson-Knox is communications director of Jewish Voice for Peace. We talked with her this week on Counterspin. And that's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at some recent press. The New York Times asked in a recent headline, "Can carbon capture live up to the hype?" The article's subhead seemed to offer an affirmative response. Quote, "The technology to capture and bury carbon dioxide has struggled to ramp up and has real limits, but experts say it could play a valuable role." Close quote. But what's the evidence? The article mostly described the failures of expensive carbon capture projects to even get off the ground. The only reference to that supposedly valuable role linked to three studies or reports. The titles of two were Carbon Capture.